This is an interview with Glenn Bjork. It's taking place at his home at 513 Moss Street in Negaunee. The date today is June 23rd, 1994, and my name is Mary Tippett Andes. This interview will deviate just a little bit from the traditional limitations on an oral history, being we want to document primarily the person's own experiences. Mr. Bjork is unique in that his grandfather, his father, he and his two sons all have worked or are still working in mining. And he has a lot to say about what he was told by his father and his grandfather, and I think that that is historically significant information that we will document. First of all, Mr. Bjork, let's start by having you give me your full name, first, middle, and last name.
My name is Glenn Charles Matthew Bjork. I'm going to tell you about a little bit about that. When we were born, my twin sister and I, we had to have the names of our grandpas and grandmas so both families would be happy. Otherwise, one would be sad, I suppose. Yeah.
Very good. Please tell me when you were born and where you were born.
January 14th, 1925, at the Gwynn Hospital.
So you were born in a hospital.
We lived in the Austin location at that time.
That's the Austin location?
Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N, Austin location. And we went home in a cutter and a horse in January.
Let me also have you give me the full names of your parents, including your mother's maiden name.
My dad was Everett E., that's Everett Eugene Bjork. His father was Carl Eric Bjork. And my mother was Emma Johns. They were a big family, Johns. You probably heard of Johns family yourself. They had 17 children. She was one of 17. And she was born in 1887. My father, Everett Eugene, was born 1891.
All right, one last question to place all of this biographical information, and that is, what nationality were your parents, and were they born in the United States or elsewhere?
My dad, Everett Bjork, was born in National Mine, Michigan. At that time, it was called Winthrop, and it was changed to National Mine later. My grandfather was born in Sweden, a province called Dalarna. That was an iron mining district too in Sweden. My mother's father and mother came from Cornwall, England. And I suppose they worked in the tin mines over there, the Johns.
So there's a long history of mining in your family. I think the most appropriate place to start then is to have you tell me about your grandfather, and continue telling me everything until you feel you've finished talking about him, and then we'll move on and talk about your dad.
Okay, I will do that. My grandfather, Carl Eric Bjork, came from Sweden in 1879. In Sweden, he came from a small town called Silverhaven. That was a mining, iron ore mining town also. And 1880, his wife to be came over from Sweden. So they were married in 1880 in the Bethany Lutheran Church, Ishpeming. That's the old church that was behind the high school, tore down. Well, Grandpa, he got work the same year he came here, 1879, at the Nelson Mine. Now, the Nelson Mine is located on U.S. 41. In fact, it's the house that has that big pipe in the front yard up from the armory. Well, that's where he began working. And he had various jobs there. In fact, he was shift bossing for a while there. After the Nelson Mine, he started to work at the Incline Mine. That wasn't a vertical shaft. It was down on an incline. And that had partly to do with the cliff shaft. It was connected. And that mine was about where the brownstone shops are in Ishpeming. Well, he worked there a few years and was transferred to the Cliff Shaft. The Cliff Shaft was called at that time the Morrow Mine. And later years changed to Cliff Shaft.
Can you spell the former name of the Cliff Shaft?
M-O-R-R-O-W. Morrow. Morrow Mine. So Grandpa lived in Ishpeming just a short time. Then he decided to move to Winthrop, which is now National Mine. So he built a house in National Mine on Mitchell Hill. And he and his three brother-in-laws built homes in that same area around Mitchell Hill. And south of the Mitchell Hill was what they called the Klondike Pit. And Grandpa worked there also at the Klondike Pit, loading horse-drawn wagons. They were loading by hand iron ore. This was an open pit.
Approximately what year would this have been?
That would have been at the Klondike Pit. It would probably be in the early 1890s. So from there, things were bad those years. He was laid off probably in his lifetime with Cleveland Cliff about 10 years. And their time didn't go on then. They started new every time. But in the 1890s, the mine shut down, so he went to Alaska to mine gold. So he was gone for a year or so up in Nome, Alaska. Of course, his family and brothers and sisters all stayed behind to milk the cows and take care of the yard and do all the work, you know. So anyway, when he came back, things picked up at the mine, so he was rehired again at the Morrow Mine, Cliff Shaft, and he got into the diamond drilling department, exploration drilling, underground and surface also. While on the diamond drills on surface, and those were big rigs, big steam operated drills. He drilled where the Ishpeming Hospital now stands to see what the ground was like to build the hospital. He also drilled at North Lake lead mine area to see where it would be the best place to put down the Lloyd shaft. So he was always kind of ahead of the game, you know, in the pioneering and stuff. So anyway, and he drilled down in Negaunee at the Negaunee mine underground. And he drilled for the Moss Mine, where they put the Moss Mine shaft. So Gwynn was starting to open up Gwynn District. It was called the Swansea Range. So Grandpa was sent down, Carl Dirk was sent down with the diamond drill crew, and they lived in tents in 1906. And they wanted to build a town site away from the mining. So the exploration drilled to see where there wasn't an ore body to put the town. So Cleveland Cliff then hired a man out of New York called William H. Manning. He was an architectural engineer, so he drew up the plans for Model Town, Gwynn, Michigan. Well, Grandpa, he worked at the various mines, Austin Mine, Princeton, Stevenson, Gwynn Mine. In fact, his last job was at the Gwynn Mine. He was a pump man down there for a few years. He retired in 1927 with 36 years. That's working years. He'd have had probably 46 if he didn't lose those years that he was off. Getting back to the Morrow Mine, his brother Adolph came over here in about 1890 to get work, and he got a job at the Morrow Mine. And in 1991, his wife came over from Sweden with five little boys. So what?
Do Do you mean
1891? That's right. She came over in 1891. Adolf came in 90. That's Grandpa's brother, Adolf. But she died from influenza, lung disease, in 1904. So that left Adolf with five little boys. So he took care of them best he could. Of course, there was no help those days from nowhere. So he went along until 1908. He was killed in a cliff shot. So there was five little boys left. So the five little boys were taken in by my grandfather, Carl Erik and Lovisa, and tried to raise them. But it got too hard for them too on account of work. Not much money now. So they were sent to an orphanage down in Joliet, Illinois. So that was the story of Grandpa's brother Adolf. He wasn't very long lived in this country.
One question that begs to be asked is, are there any records of these kids that would be your second cousins?
Your second cousins, that's right. Yes, I know a little about them. One of the five orphan boys, well, they all went in the army, World War I, 1918, excepting one. But they all went over to France, the four of the boys went to France and came back after the war and were discharged, and they kind of scattered around the country. One of the boys, in fact, was discharged out of Fort Snelling, Minnesota, and they never heard him to this day. I have letters yet that my dad wrote to government about where they wrote to dad about where his whereabouts were, but he didn't know. I met one of the boys, Carl. He lived in Syracuse, New York. I met him twice, in fact, But yeah, they were spread around the country. One of the boys came home, Gunnard. He thought the military would be a good place, so he put another 20 years in the Marine Corps out in California. And I never did meet him or the other one, but there was no contact with them.
At least you knew what happened to them after they were...
Yeah, I don't know where they went. Well, yes, now there's one. I didn't know the father, but his son, Harold Bjork, has visited us up here in Negaunee a few times. And they have one son. But we had a family reunion at this house one year, Bjork's family reunion. So there was, we had a good gathering of the Bjorks in Detroit from this one of the orphan boys, children. And like I say, we visited back and forth some, not back and forth, we're not travelers. They came up here and we visited them here.
All right, before that little digression, then you were at the point where the five children, the five boys, had been sent to Joliet, Illinois. And then we want to pick up that thread with your grandfather and grandmother again. Then what happened to them after that?
To the five orphan boys?
No, to your after the boys went. Where did your what did your grandparents do then?
Well, after they he was still in the mine, of course, and that's about the time that they moved to Gwin. You see. That was early 1900 that one mother died and Adolf was killed in the mine. And so it was that time that he was working diamond drills in Gwin, 1904, 5, 6 in there. And the town site of Gwin was built in 1908. So actually he was still in the mines while the boys were down in the orphanage home. Yeah. But
so now we have your grandfather working at the Gwin mine, and we want to pick up the story of your grandfather and continue forward with it then at
I could add a little bit to that. He retired in 1927. I think I told you 27 at the Gwin mine, and I think there was 2 years he was caretaker, he and grandma, at the town hall in Gwin, kept things clean and that, you know. In 1930, he made a trip back to Sweden after 51 years. He and his sister, Hulda Lund from Rockford, Illinois, made a trip back and to see his remaining three sisters. That's all that was left over there. But yeah, he was gone, never saw his mother and dad no more after he left in 1879. Yeah, 51 years and before he went back.
Do you recall your grandfather ever talking much about what his experiences were underground at all? Any things that he...
Not too much on grandpa's, because we were kind of young then too, you see. But I know when he was pump man, he had time on their hands. They keep the pumps going, greased and everything. But he used to carve out of that pump rubber. It was kind of a hard rubber gasket, about an inch thick. But he carved for me a whole set of farm animals with him.
Do you still have them?
I have one yet, a little rocking horse. See, in Sweden, in Sweden where he came from, that province, Dalarna, maybe you heard of it, it's called Dalarna, a red hest. That's a red horse, you know, a rocking horse. Well, they've done a lot of carving, and especially those days. I think they still do. It's a business, bigger business now. But people are interested in carving, mm-hmm. carving things. So he made me a complete set of farm animals out of rubber. It's interesting. Yeah. So he went over there anyway in 1930, visited, and sent a letter home to my twin sister and I, Gloria. Told us not to run away from Grandma Bolson, as we called her. My grandmother was dead at the time, so that's why Grandpa and his sister Hulda went to Sweden. But there was another old lady that came there to look after us while he was gone. Yeah. My mother died in 1929, that's 65 years ago. John's, Emma John. And I used to go with Grandpa quite a lot, Gloria and I. He had a Pontiac car. Every now and then he'd take a trip up to Iskamingen National Mine to visit old Swede friends and talk Swede. Up to Lundin's farm and Dave Farms and over here at Buffalo Hill he had a relative. Gloria and I would be in the back seat then. We'd be bouncing along from Gwinda up here. And of course, we'd horse around. He'd stop the car and he'd get out and he'd go cut a switch off a tree. Give us a rap, eh? We'd be good for a few miles, you know. And then he always had a habit of wood wheels, wood spokes. He always stopped at Green Creek on the way up to Ishpeming. That's down by Gwynn, Green Creek. And put water on the spokes, I suppose. He figured they're drying out or something. So keep them wet. Yeah. And then there was an old Swede guy called Beckmans. They lived in Gwynn. And down on the Silver and Red Creek, east of Gwynn, that's in fact where the air base is now, Silver and Red starts there. But they had a small operation. They sunk a shaft there for a silver and lead mine. This always kind of intrigued me. That Beckman always said, he was kind of a dreamer. He always said that this is going to be a big silver and lead mine someday. It's going to be all brick buildings. And it would be all Swedes working. I see, I kick out of here nothing. But anyway, the mine never went ahead any further either, and it filled up with water. I suppose it was down 100 feet maybe or something. So I got a kind of a kick out of that. We picked a lot of berries with Grandpa and Grandma, blueberries. Look under the yak pines, he said, that's where you find the blueberry. Yeah. And of course, growing up, we had to go and pick berries, that's all. Whether you liked it or not, come home with bushels of them. Hot and dry, and them crickets making noise out. Yeah, it was fun, though, looking back. That was a lot of fun. Yeah. And of course, they always had their calls. We had a call, and Gwen, Grandpa, would have a call, Grandma, get the milk and butter and everything, you know.
Did you milk the cow?
Well, I suppose I tried it when I was little. Grandpa took care of that, I think, pretty much. Yeah.
Shall we talk a little bit about your dad now?
Yeah, sure. We'll go to my dad. Everett E. Bjork is my dad. He was born in 1891 at National Mine, or Winthrop called those days. And went to school, National Mine School, and of course Sunday school. They all had to attend Sunday school. It was all in Swedish those days too. They had to learn that. And of course he heard at home too. He was very fluent in Swedish, even though he was born here. But anyway, he went to school until he was, as I remember him talking, 16 years old. That'd be about 1907. So he wanted to quit school. So Grandpa said, his dad said, if you're going to quit school, you're going to go to a business college. You're not going to go to work. You're going to go to school some more yet. Ishpeming at that time had what they called the Ishpeming Business College in Ishpeming. So he enrolled in the Ishpeming Business College. I suppose about a year, maybe, and then he got a job at the main office for Cleveland Cliffs, a basement office. Of course, then things were opening up, like I told you before, with Gwin District, so he was sent to the Gwin District. In fact, they moved to Gwin in 1908, the Austin location, and Dad was worked out of the main office at Princeton. And he worked underground some with surveyors and that sort. He was mostly office work all his life. He worked at all the mine offices. When the mine shut down in Gwin, the last one I think was 1921, the Princeton mine shut down. And he kept them at, that wasn't the last mine, excuse me. The Mackinac mine ran until 1938, so he took care of the mine office at the Mackinac mine. But from 1938, he was back at the main office in Princeton. He took care of all the Cliff Bar and Lake accounts. That's for Gwin, Little Lake, Chatham, Ebbin, all the way down to Seine, you know. It was a big job, too. And of course, 1941, they pumped out and reopened the Princeton mine after 20 years it was closed for the war effort, World War II. And so they got a bigger staff in the office at that time. They had a mine clerk, supply clerk, and so on. But then that closed after that strike in 1946. And he was kept on at that same office until about 1956 on Cliff Bar and Lake accounts. And they shut the Princeton mine office down then. And he was going to retire, but CCR officials wanted them to go up to the Mather Cottage up on the hill in Ishpeming, where all the higher-ups come from Cleveland to stay. And so Ma did the cooking and Pa was the butlering. So they enjoyed it up there. They really met a lot of nice people, and they were there then until 1962. And then he retired after 54 and a half years. And 1975 he passed away. So what is that, about 13 years he had, he retired, 62 to 75, yeah. Yeah, my dad remarried in 1933, I told you my mother died in 1929, Emma Johns Bjork, she died in 1929, and 1933 he married a girl, her family grew up or was in Rock, Michigan, not south of Gwin. And she certainly was a hard worker too, bigger farmer type, you know. Picked the berries during the season, a lot of, canning and a big garden, flower garden. And Pa, he'd bring home the trout. He was avid trout fisherman too, hunting and fishing. That's where I learned from him.
In your family, are you and your sister the only children?
I had a brother that was a little bit older, or he was older than us. I forget the exact year he was born, but he lived a year and 14 days and died. And I guess she had other pregnancies that she couldn't carry him, I guess, carry the children very good. And then Gloria and I came along, and thank the Lord we made it fine. We lived. But I guess that was kind of her downfall. She got Parkinson's after that. And all I can remember in my mind of my mother was laying in a hospital bed in our home in Gwin. I can see her laying there. That's the only recollection I really have of her.
And you would have been how old when your mother passed away?
We were 4 years old. Four years old.
Any particular things that you remember as a child doing with your dad and your stepmom that stand out in your mind in terms of ordinary things that you did or extraordinary things that you did or things that you remember from your childhood that were significantly different than when you became an adult and had a family of your own?
Well, like I told you before, even with grandparents there, of course, and he always kind of looked after us. Well, of course, my mother died in those years there, but and then when she came, it was a lot of, like I said, picking berries and helping around home. Kids had to help out there, you know. And make wood every year, cut wood, and Dad and I with the cross-cut saws on wood and piling it in the barn. Of course, now and then they'd load the kids and Gloria and I in the car, and they'd go out to some fishing stream and fish and make a lunch out there, make a fire. And Ma, one time I remember, forgot the frying pan to fry the eggs and bacon or whatever it was. So they washed the shovel off. She fried it on the shovel. It tasted good too, you know. Yeah, had a lot of good times. There was nothing like nowadays. I mean, everybody got to be buzzing somewhere, you know, going. It was simpler, I guess, more simple life. Yeah, but enjoyable.
I guess the next question I'd like to ask is getting closer now to your life. How long did you go to school?
I went 12 years at Gwin High School, graduated out of there. Yeah.
And what did you do after high school?
That was the war years again. See, we went from school and into the military.
You graduated in what year?
1943. So in 1943, I graduated out of school. Well, I started for the company in March 43. That was part-time work I had until I was out of school. 3 months there, March, April, May, June, yeah, 2.5 months or so. And then I worked steady at the Princeton Mine until August 43, and when I was out of the military. So I went in the Navy, joined the Navy. You had a choice those days whether you wanted to go in, so I chose the Navy. I was out in the Pacific for 3 years. Bought an aircraft carrier Hornet, probably heard of that, during the war years. Yeah,
this is tape number one, side number two of the interview with Glenn Bjork, taking place at his home on Moss Street in Nagani on June 23rd, 1994. And my name is Mary Tippett Andes. While we were in the process of turning the tape over, Mr. Bjork commented about his work on his family tree and wanted to comment on that for a moment.
Yeah, I figured I'd make up a family tree for our four children, so they'd have something to go on someday too, you know, there. But it was a five-year project. But what came in on the Swedish part of the family tree? I go to Swedish school in the winters here, Ishpeming. And the Swedish teacher had been in this country, I suppose, about 12 years now. But she gave me a lot of information. In fact, when she went over there one year to visit her family, she stopped at this little town of Silverhaven and asked about our family. And the girl working in the restaurant said, yeah, she lives over there, your relative, lived over there. So she went over and met, he'd be my second cousin's parents, Gustav Carlson and his wife Anna, and I had a little visit with them. And so she came back with a lot of information for me. And I also wrote to the church in that town, Rusnarsberg Church, and I got a lot of information on that dating back to 1700s. And it was very interesting. And in growing up, I'd ask my dad from time to time, do we have any relatives in Sweden? And of course, my dad would say, I suppose. And come to find out, on his church records, he had 21 first cousins over there. So I've been writing to them for the last 5-6 years in Swedish. They don't read any English. Their daughter does. So I tricked them one time and sent an English letter, but their daughter could read it, see. And then I have another cousin lives over there, married to he was a journalist for about 30 years for the Swedish national newspaper. Of course, he speaks and reads and writes English. So there was no trouble there. But for me to write a letter and all, I got to start in October, so I'll have the letter ready by December to send it over to them, you know. So it's been an interesting project, but that's where I got started, really. The sweet teacher found relatives, and I wrote to this church, too. They have a lot of good records over there, a lot of really good records. And on the other side, the family, the Johnses, I had an uncle, Johnny Johns. He passed away about 3 years ago. He was to England, Cornwall, England. Three trips he made over there, he and his wife, Alice. He never found anything on their family. So I couldn't do much on that side. I put down in the family tree what I could, and just a little what I've heard around here, but yeah, he never found any records. But so, some of the names change, I guess, too. Another party told me in Uganda here that their name might have been Jones. Over there or something. They changed it to John. But Johnny couldn't find any relatives. But it was interesting too about my grandfather Bjork. When he came from Sweden, his name was Carl Erik Johnson. But when he got to Ishpeming, there were so many Johnsons, he figured he better change it to Bjork. So he and his brother both changed their name to Bjork.
Did he say how they chose the name?
No, I never did hear that unless there's all these Bjork trees around. These birch trees are Bjorks. All these white birch, you see? Translate birch, a Bjork, it means birch. Yeah? So I suppose really that's what that means. Bjork trees. Yeah.
We're going to pick up again now with post-World War II, and I'd like to ask you, after the war was over, what did you do?
1946, I was discharged out of the Navy. I came back and had a big strike on you, 46 strike. So Cliff Pond Light picked up a bunch of us fellas. We went out and cut a power line around the Shag Lakes. So we all had, not all, but several of us got some work there. But when the strike was over, I went to Matheray, worked at the Matheray shack.
What did you do at the Matheray? And do you remember what year that was?
Yes, it was in 1946. I worked there mining. In fact, we were rock drifting a main heading over to where the Mather B shaft would be in Igani, driving a drift over there.
What is a main heading?
That's the main level drifts. And a cross cut then. They try to keep a main line or the main drift in rock, in a foot rock, a hole up good. And off of the main line, they cross cut into the ore bodies, where they drifted ahead into the ore body and laid track and had to haul the ore out on the underground trains. But yeah.
Can I ask you if you remember what your very first day working at the mine was?
At Princeton Mine? Very first day, Princeton Mine. I enjoyed it. A big deal. I enjoyed working there.
This would have been while you were still in high school, though, at the Princeton Mine. Was that right?
I worked part-time until I graduated, and then I worked full-time at the Princeton Mine. And I enjoyed every minute of it.
Why was that? You're laughing at me.
I suppose there must be a mining blood in me or something, I suppose.
What was your first day at the Princeton Mine like? Do you remember?
Well, you know, when you go down the mine, it's all new, like you're in a different world. You know, you got your light on your hat and a few light bulbs along the main drift that are all muddy and dirty and wet places. And yeah.
Did they play any jokes on you as a high school kid coming
in? No. I never had any jokes played on me. And, you know, that's a hard one for me to remember a little bit about jokes, what they did for people. It's an interesting place to go down in there. Get in a cage and go down.
That's a
new world.
That's a new world. Nobody that I've talked to has talked much about the Princeton Mine. Were there any characteristics about the Princeton Mine that were noticeably different from your later experience?
Well, sure. Princeton Mine was a soft ore body. In fact, there was raises they brought up. That's where they go up to another level with a raise, it's called. And they put cribbing, tamarack cribbing, to keep it from caving in. And there was places in the Princeton Mine they never had a drilling blast. It was so soft. They put a spade on a milling machine and just spade the ore out, and then put more cribbing rounds of cribbing and keep going up. Yeah, it was soft ground.
How many levels was the Princeton Mine down?
Princeton Mine was two levels, fifth and sixth. Yeah. In fact, we had to walk in, oh, I suppose 1,000 feet or so to go down to sixth at the time I worked there. But then during the war, they sunk the shaft. Main shaft down to the sixth level. So it was connected up then. Yeah.
Let's go ahead a little bit now and get you back to the time that you started working at the Matheray.
Well, yeah, Matheray shaft, sure, after the war there. After we worked for Cliff Barnley, we went to Matheray. And I got into rock drifting there. This rock drift main line was heading toward Negaunee to eventually hook up with the Mather B shaft when it was sunk. So I worked over in that drift until 1947 in January, as I remember, January or February, the mining broke into the old Nelson mine and water. That was kind of spooky. We all thought another barn checker. And we worked in that for several days. We had to roll our boots as high as they go. and the motor splashing through water.
How high did you have to roll your boots?
Right up to your knees, right halfway up, pretty close up to your knees. The water was on the main line, right on the main drift.
How did you feel working in those conditions?
Well, you know, I don't know. It's hard to look back. I didn't think too much of it. You went there every day and done your job and splashed through the water and wondered when it was going to quit coming, you know. Well, anyway, they sent everybody home then. It was a little concern to be another barn checker. So they had a skeleton crew there put in some dams so the water wouldn't come out and flood the main shaft. So that gave us an opportunity to take in the ski tournaments when the mine was down. So we just about every day went from Gwynn up there to the ski tournament. So anyway, it petered out, the water did. Mm-hmm. Grandpa's water came down after. That's where he started at the Nelson mine. Yeah, so I worked there until 1947. We started to sink the Mather B shaft. So we went over there that fall of 47. First of all, we had blasted up on the hill for that engine house. We had to blast that rock out, make a flat spot, you know, for the engine house and for that. And then we started to sink shaft. We had a wooden head frame at that time on our sinking shaft. You know what a head frame is?
I was going to ask you to define what a head frame is.
That's where what you see on surface, the steel shaft house.
It's like a structure over the top.
That's right, over the shaft, you know.
And but at the time you were sinking shaft from Mather B, it was wooden?
Wood timbers. It was erected with wood timbers.
Was it open to the weather?
And it was closed in some. Yeah, they closed in the best they could.
And what month was this?
This was in about February, March, April. In the spring, anyway, we started sinking. But we sunk that down to 3,100 feet bottom there, and then we went back up and started to blast ahead where the levels would be. Started at the sixth level and then the seventh. But there was 225 feet there between levels. Some of the older mines, I think Cliff Shaft was even 50, 60, 70 feet. It was hard work, see. They could go less. But it was 225 feet between levels at the Mather A, I imagine, same thing. But what was an interesting thing, when we opened up sixth level, we drilled and blasted the rock for the plat. That's the white spot out by the shaft, where there was two set of tracks where they unloaded timber trucks and all of that to come off the cage. And then went around on the other side of the pillar. We left the pillar in there, and then we opened up that side for the trenches. That's where the ore cars dumped ore, in these trenches. And then they had a scraper into a measuring pocket. That measuring pocket held exactly a skip load. I forget, it was 10 ton, 15 ton skips. I forget anymore now. But yeah, so when we had that done, Mather A drift kept coming towards Negaunee, the one I worked in. This was kind of a highlight, I thought, my time. My partner and I, Sam Carilli, were advancing that drift, main drift, from the Mather B side. We had about 400 feet to go. And so Sam and I had the honor of busting it through to the Mather A. Yeah.
What did that feel like?
When the smoke cleared, there was the Mather A bunch there. We went over and talked to them, you know.
Did you do any kind of a ceremonial handshake or anything like that?
Well, I suppose we shook hands, chewed the rag, and we held her through anyway. Yeah, that was kind of. So my boy, I started, and we broke through. First ones to break through with Mather A, and my boy closed the mine. So it's been kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you arrived at the spot where the Mather B was going to go down, you said you cleared a spot and leveled it off to put the engine house in.
Yeah.
Can you describe for me, once that
structure was up over the top, the superstructure was up over the top of where the shaft was going to go. Can you go over for me the process that you used? Did you set charges and blast and then take the rock out? When you started going down, for whatever the first excavation, the engine house up there,
we had to blast that level.
Okay.
Drill holes all over and blasting. When we blasted, we had to put big mats and we had to put trees over them because there was houses just below there. So we never broke a window ever, though. And then the bulldozer on surface, he pushed the rock out, see. Yeah.
And once you had that flat spot and you were ready to actually start sinking the shaft, can you describe for me the steps that you went through of how you got the shaft sunk?
Yeah, well, the first thing you do, you got to drill about 65 holes. There was 10 men on the shift.
How deep were the holes?
Well, they go anywhere from 8 foot, pull 8 foot down. We put even, 10 foot we pulled. That much ground broke. But you'd go down, you'd blast, drill and blast, and then you'd go down, I suppose, about 28 feet anyway, below the last set of steel. There were steel sets in there, it wasn't timber. And then you'd rig up a staging. We had a staging there that was anchored on four corners. You have a chain block, you lift that up and then to take a hook off and then of a set above. And then you'd lower that down, that would lower down 7 feet, 8 feet. And then you would put planks, transfer planks across all of that staging, we call it. And then they'd start to bring down the steel, side plates and end plates and dividers and ladder load. We'd do all of that before we went down again to muck that pile out. And muck the pile out, then you keep that, I say, about 28 feet ahead of the last set. So it wouldn't hurt that set when you blast.
Mm-hmm.
If you brought the sets too close down, that blast might upset that set, see, buckle it, you know.
Now, I need to have you tell me what exactly a steel set is.
Well, a steel set is you've seen I-beams or H-beams, you've seen that in construction. I suppose they were about 10 by 10, as I remember, 8 by 10, whatever. And they'd run the full, they were 20 feet long, 20, 21 feet long, and 14 feet wide on the end sets. And they were hung there with a, it was a big corner studdle, we call them. Big piece of angle iron that was machined already with the holes. And you can put that up and hang it to the last set above with a drifter in there and then put the bolts. Excuse me. And then on the four corner pieces, then you put in your wall plates. They'd rest on them. And your end plates. And two dividing sets in the middle. Across the center of the shaft. This is the cage road, in other words. And then you'd have a divider, and you'd have another divider with that same steel, and you'd put a platform on that one every 8 feet, 7 feet. And that's your ladder road, in case power went out or something, you have to climb up. Well, anyway, the other divider on the other side was the skip roads. There was two skip compartments. That's where Holly Ore up to serve. Two skips they had there. So you had a cage road, ladder road, and two skip roads. So there was, as I remember, about 14 by 21, something like that, the shaft was size.
And as you were putting the sets in, did the sets include the steel walls or just the framing?
That's just the framing. The walls, we didn't do a whole lot with the walls. Where it was bad, if we were down below the sets, we would bring a lot of 3-inch plank down and put it in behind that last set and then block it from behind so that the plank would hold the wall from anything caving down on us. See? Yeah, so the walls were kept pretty good trim. We trimmed them down pretty good then. And that, and of course, when we were drilling down there, they kept the cage down low on the cage roadside. I drilled that side myself all the way down. And of course, on the skip road side, they always had sheet iron. They covered that with sheet iron so nothing would fall. So you're kind of protected that way. When the road's going, you can't hear anything, you know, anything drop or anything. So, yeah.
What's mucking?
That's shoveling. Well, we shoveled on about, hand shovel. I don't know. I kind of forget some of these things. It seems to me it was about maybe around 1,000 feet, 800 feet. And then they got a hydro mucker in there. That was a hydraulic. You see these clamshells on construction that goes like this, bite the sand, you know, and lift it. Well, anyway, it was called a Rodel mucker. I think that was devised by Houghton engineer. But there was a motor that run the hydraulic pump. One man run the pump, or he run the open and close the bucket. And then we had what they call a tray down the bottom with a bale on it. We'd load that tray, and then we'd bring the cage down to the bottom. That was a sinking cage, open cage. But this tray had two hooks on it. And we had a tugger always above. We keep bringing that down as we needed. An air tugger. You heard of an air tugger? That's a thing to pull. You pull with timber or anything you need to pull with air. But this was air. But this air tugger would lift this tray, and it was centered, so it automatically go towards the cage. And then as you lifted that tray, there was two hooks. It would catch on bars on the cage. And as you kept lifting here on the bale, the tugger would keep lifting it. Well, then that thing would automatically just go up. And that would dump into a car on the cage. Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty good recovery we always had. The 65 holes, we generally run about 65 cars. So each hole was working about a car.
Now, how many guys were there on the crew that you had when you were sinking shaft, and were there three shifts of crews?
Three shifts, day? Yeah, 5 days a week that we worked, weekends off. Yeah, 10 men on the crew, 10 drills going, and the same men for mucking and putting steel. We all worked together.
About how many feet per day?
Well, I'm going to tell you, we set a North American record shaft sinking at that time. We're there. A half is 2 weeks. We used to call it a half. How much you make this half? We got paid every couple of weeks, 2 weeks. But for two consecutive months, or halves, I should say, we had 100 feet. So that was 200 feet for the month. So that was a shaft sinking for that type of shaft on that side.
Was there any kind of an incentive program for you to sink shaft faster?
Well, sure. It was all under contract mining. You got paid for so much a foot. Don't ask me what that is. I can't remember a lot of them figures, what it was per foot. But we'd come out with about, what does that really go out? What, $15, $16 a day, I guess, would come. But that was a little different later on when you were making $40, $50, $60 a day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was big money then. They paid good money for shaft sinking. It was above contract pay at the other mine, you know. It was an incentive, yeah.
How were the guys chosen to sink shaft?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with probably what mining experience you had, probably, and wherever you're working, and your willingness to work and steadiness. And they didn't want people there losing time or nothing, you know, work steady. Yeah.
And you had worked before you sank shaft at the Matter B. You had worked at the Matter A for how long?
Matter A before. Well, it was at 46 until the fall of 87 that we went over to the sink shaft at the B.
Fall of 87, you said?
Yeah. No, not 87. 46 to 47 we went over there. 47. Yeah, Matty Beekler shut down 1979. So 1946, I went to Madrid, and the fall of 47, we went over to drill that engine house and start sinking shaft.
How many levels, when you sank shaft at the Mather B, did you start every level that there ultimately was at the Mather B, or were other levels put in after the shaft was sunk and it was in operation for a while?
No, the levels were pretty well opened up. Six levels were the first one opened up, the plat and the trenches, and then, of course, then they dropped down to the next seventh level and do the same there. So that was all done really before the rock drifting went ahead towards Mather A. That had to be done anyway to get rid of the rock or whatever you had. You had to have trenches for to dump your material and and to hoist it to surface.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me the approximate dimensions of a plat?
Well, the cage roadside plat, I think we're using about 14 or 16 foot caps. You stand two legs, that's what a set is, two legs and a cap. It was all steel they were using at that time. And 10 feet high right by the shaft, and then anyone ahead of maybe 100 feet, you'll start cutting down until it finally got down to 9 feet high. You had to have that height there for lowering steel, rails and 30-foot rails that'll come off that cage. And that's, you got to have height there. And like I say, it was probably 16-foot, 18-foot cap. So that gave you about a 20-foot width on the floor. That two set of tracks in there. One came off the cage and it had a switch there, and there was two sets of tracks. And the trench side where they dumped, well, that side was just as long. I suppose it was 150, 200 feet altogether, and just as wide, maybe a little bit wider on the cage or on the skip side. You had no about the same, maybe about 20 feet, 21 feet. See, your rails tracks went right along that trench. A trench is we blasted out a trench probably 100 feet long, and on two sides of the shaft, and about, I suppose that went down about 10 feet, and then that was all cemented, of course, concrete, that was each side of the shaft. So when motors came out with their ore, they had a color camelback outfit there. The ore cars had a fifth wheel. So when the motors pulled ahead in there, they could move that camel back wherever, on the rock side or the ore side. But if they had ore, you'd keep pulling this train through, and as each train, the fifth wheel would catch the camel back, go up, well, that car would dump into the trench.
Describe for me what the camel back is made out of and how high it was.
Well, that's made out of steel, too, and it had a...
Like a railroad track?
No, it isn't a railroad track. You had the railroad tracks where your ore trains run on, the ground ore train. But this was an outfit set up that you could move it where you wanted it by the trench, and there was pins in there through the rail to hold it from tipping, dumping, you know, or just hold it there for one thing. Well, there's an angle iron on the bottom. The ore cars, underground cars, had a plate. And when this came to this camelback, it would go under a plate on the camelback. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
So when the ore car's fifth wheel hit this camelback, if this wasn't under this plate, it took the whole car into. In other words, the trucks, the wheels, stayed on the track. It was just a body that dumped sideways.
So on the side of the car closest to the trench, there was like a little a catch, basically, that would hold that one side of the car down.
No, it was on the opposite side of the trench.
Oh, okay.
Opposite side. The camelback was on the opposite side of the tracks from the trench. The trench side was open. There was nothing on that side. The camelback was on the outer side of the motor and the cars. So when you're each car dumped, there was nothing on the trench side free. The car just dumped its load there on the side.
But did I understand correctly that opposite the camelback on the trench side, was there something that would hold that downside of the body of the ore cart, hold that down so that as the camelback end tipped up,
When that wheel went over that camelback, I was telling you they had a plate on the ore car, and that came, and there was a plate on the camelback.